Good morning. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on SunSounds of Arizona for the 13th of January, 2026. This is your volunteer reader and flag staff, Chuck Kaufman, bringing you these headlines from the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Fed chief hits back at Trump. President ramps up private criticism of Bondi. U.S. tries fresh tack on regime change. That first headline is by Nick Timiraos. Fed chief hits back at Trump. Powell avoided for years taking on president directly. That is now over. For years, Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell has responded to President Trump's broadsides in ways that generally avoided escalation. That changed on Sunday night. In an extraordinary two-minute video message, Powell accused the administration of using the threat of criminal prosecution to pressure the Fed into lowering rates. He framed the Justice Department investigation as nothing less than a head-on challenge to the Fed's ability to operate free of political control. The subpoenas arrived late Friday. Powell, a lawyer by training, spent the weekend huddled with advisors weighing how to respond. Powell made clear by releasing the video statement that he wasn't going to let this play out in the shadows. A criminal investigation of a sitting chair is without precedent, and Powell's message was too. It was wrapped in a directness that he had spent years avoiding. Powell often chooses his words carefully, and Sunday's unusually stern delivery lacked the diplomatic off-ramp and studied neutrality of his past comments about the White House. The threat of criminal charges is a consequence of the Federal Reserve setting interest rates based on our best assessment of what will serve the public rather than following the preference of the president, Powell said. By going public, Powell was making sure the pressure applied in private couldn't stay private. The decision to disclose the investigation appeared to reflect a belief that the public should know what was unfolding. The threat of the prosecution of a sitting Fed chair would be material information for investors or anyone else trying to understand the forces shaping interest rate deliberations. On Monday, former Fed officials and lawmakers from both sides of the aisle criticized the Powell investigation. The probe also sparked unease on Wall Street, where many investors have long believed the Fed should be free from political influence when setting rates. Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, a Republican, said the administration's investigation is nothing more than an attempt at coercion and warned of financial fallout if the president continued his campaign to bend the traditionally independent central bank to his will. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said Monday that Trump didn't direct prosecutors to investigate Powell. The president has every right to criticize the Fed chair, she said. Monday's market reaction was muted, indicating investors think that Trump will likely be unsuccessful in his efforts to dictate Fed policy. U.S. stock indexes rebounded following early losses, with both the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 edging up 0.2% to close at record highs. U.S. Attorney Jeanine Pirro, whose Washington office is running the investigation, said on X, "This office makes decisions based on the merits, nothing more and nothing less." Some Trump allies have been optimistic that the pressure campaign would get Powell to give up, resigning before his term as chair ends in May. Alternatively, it could ensure he would leave the Fed's board at that point, which would give Trump a second vacancy to fill on the Fed's seven-person board. Powell holds a separate term as a governor that would permit him to stay on the board until early 2028, giving Trump only one vacancy to fill before then. But if the administration expected Powell to fold, his video remarks Sunday suggested they had misjudged him. Even before news of the investigation, Powell had hired Williams & Connolly, one of Washington's premier litigation firms, as outside counsel, a precaution given the administration's escalating pressure on the Fed might turn legal. He's also spent years cultivating allies on Capitol Hill. Public service sometimes requires standing firm in the face of threats, Powell said in his statement. I will continue to do the job the Senate confirmed me to do with integrity and a commitment to serving the American people. Trump, a Republican, has long pushed for lower interest rates, which stimulate growth and tend to lift stock prices. The Fed cut rates three times last year, largely because Powell led the central bank to do so over deepening disagreements over whether stubborn inflation warranted higher rates. Powell has insisted the central bank sets policy based on economic conditions, not political preferences. Presidents have complained about interest rate decisions before. Lyndon Johnson reportedly shoved Fed Chairman William McChesney Martin against a wall over interest rates. But the central bank's independence from the White House has been a bedrock principle of economic policy for decades. The investigation centers on Powell's congressional testimony last June about a $2.5 billion project to renovate historic Fed buildings near the National Mall. White House officials alleged last year that Powell either made false statements about the project's costs or failed to comply with permitting requirements. Powell said the building project was just a cover story. The real target was the Fed's independence on rates. The latest escalation caught analysts off guard because Powell had played a key role in delivering lower interest rates at the Fed's last three meetings. Without Powell to act as a shield, it's easy to see Trump quickly turning his ire toward the remaining FOMC participants, said Tim Duy, chief U.S. economist at research firm SGH Macro Advisors. The question now is how Trump responds to Powell's blunt declaration that he won't be intimidated. The administration can back off or escalate further. One possibility is that Trump could seek to fire Powell outright, citing negligence on the Fed's building renovation project. Trump himself undercut that rationale in July when he toured the construction site and demurred when he was asked if it was a fireable offense. "Look, there's always Monday morning quarterbacks. I don't want to be that," he said. Any attempt to fire Powell would likely end up in court, where Trump's efforts to remove Fed Governor Lisa Cook are already being contested. The Supreme Court is set to hear arguments later this month over the president's power to dismiss Fed officials. The next Fed chair will be confirmed in the shadow of this moment. Whoever it is will face a confirmation hearing in which senators and markets will be asking a question that didn't exist before Sunday night. Would this person risk prosecution to do the job the way Powell did? Trump has now made it crystal clear that he'll accept no less than the Fed bending its knee to him and its decision-making, said Eswar Prasad, an economist at Cornell University. Trump's pick could also face more scrutiny from the Senate as a result of the latest escalation. Senator Tom Tillis, Republican of North Carolina, said Sunday he'd block any nominee until the investigation is resolved, a warning that the administration's pressure campaign could create new problems even as it attempts to solve old ones. That's Fed chief hits back at Trump. Next, we have President ramps up private criticism of Bondi. Complaints in recent weeks center on failed prosecutions handling of Epstein. This is by Josh Dossi, Sadie Gurman, and C. Ryan Barber. President Trump has complained to aides repeatedly in recent weeks about Attorney General Pam Bondi, describing her as weak and an ineffectual enforcer of his agenda, administration officials and other people familiar with his complaints said. The criticisms appear to be part of an intense campaign by Trump to pressure the Justice Department to more aggressively pursue his priorities, some of the officials said. Trump has previously criticized Bondi at times, but his vocal concerns about his attorney general have grown more frequent in recent months, officials said. This month, Trump has talked with allies about how he could appoint special counsels at the Justice Department because he is so frustrated with what he sees as the slow play progress of its work, people familiar with the matter said. Chief among his grievances is what he sees as Bondi's failure to quickly and effectively prosecute the investigators who had pursued him for years, including former FBI Director James Comey and New York Democrat Attorney General Letitia James, the officials and others familiar with his complaint said. Both criminal cases were dismissed in November by a judge who said the Trump aide who secured the indictment had been improperly appointed to her post. a Justice Department investigation into another of Trump's antagonists, Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, became public on Sunday night. Powell disclosed that the Justice Department was pursuing a criminal investigation over his testimony last summer about the central bank's building renovation. Trump, a Republican, has also complained frequently that Bondi's handling of the Federal Bureau of Investigation's files on convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein has created months of political and personal headaches for him, officials familiar with the complaint said. When White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles told Vanity Fair that Bondi whiffed on her handling of the files, Trump told staff that he agreed with Wiles, two officials said. He's also heard from conservative activists and influencers criticizing Bondi and collected similar social media posts that he has asked other aides about, the officials said. And Trump has expressed in frustration that the Justice Department hasn't done more to pursue those he claims helped steal the 2020 election, which he lost, some of the people familiar with the complaint said. At times, Trump has complained to Bondi directly about his frustrations with the department, officials said. Bondi has grown increasingly concerned in the past month about Trump's complaints, people in touch with her said. A spokesman for Bondi said she's been focusing on executing Trump's directive to make the country safe again. In a statement to the Wall Street Journal on Friday afternoon, Trump said, "Pam is doing an excellent job. She's been my friend for many years. Tremendous progress is being made against radical left lunatics who are good at only one thing, cheating in elections and crimes they commit." The White House also sent on Friday statements from Vice President J.D. Vance, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Wiles, and other senior officials, all praising Bondi. Late Friday, the Fed received grand jury subpoenas from the Justice Department that threaten a criminal indictment. The Bondi spokesman said she had instructed her U.S. attorneys to prioritize investigating any abuses of taxpayer dollars. Trump is at times warm personally with Bondi, a former Florida attorney general who once was one of his personal attorneys, including at the Kennedy Center Honors Ceremony Trump hosted last month, a person familiar with their interactions said. Other officials at the Justice Department have also come under criticism from the president, people familiar with the criticism said. Trump's comments on Bondi reflect those of some of his MAGA supporters. While she once enjoyed strong backing among the president's voters, longtime Trump ally Steve Bannon said, "Bondi is now bleeding support from her and President Trump's most loyal troops. Folks are desperate for action and just haven't seen it," Bannon said, providing a list of topics that the president's supporters want her to bring more cases on, including the 2020 election and the Justice Department's investigation into Trump campaign ties to Russia in the 2016 election. Bondi has been less visible around the White House in recent months, White House officials said. She didn't appear with Trump to announce the extraordinary capture of President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela, even though her agency was the one whose prosecution underpinned the arrest. A Justice Department official said that Bondi was following Maduro's seizure in real time and that travel logistics combined with the sensitive nature of the operation kept her from attending. Trump had fraught relationships with his first-term attorneys general. He pushed out Jeff Sessions over the Russia probe. William Barr ultimately resigned after saying investigators had found no widespread fraud that would have changed Trump's 2020 election loss. The better an attorney is, the more process-oriented they're going to be, and that is in direct opposition to what Trump wants, which is someone who is outcome-oriented, said Sarah Isger, who served as a spokeswoman for Sessions at the Justice Department. He can never find a great attorney general because, by definition, they can't be a great lawyer. Trump's building frustration with Bondi spilled into public view in September when he pushed her to prosecute Comey and James in a social media post that he'd intended to send as a private message. He installed Lindsey Halligan, a White House aide, to run the federal prosecutor's office in Virginia handling the probes, and she indicted Comey and James within weeks of her arrival. The cases have been on life support after a judge ruled Halligan's appointment was unlawful and dismissed both prosecutions. The Justice Department has failed to persuade at least two grand juries to indict James since then. The Justice Department's release of the Epstein files has also kept Trump's past relationship with the disgraced financier in the spotlight. Trump has said he cut off ties long before Epstein was first arrested in 2006. As the Justice Department released tranches of Epstein files over the holidays, Trump again complained about Bondi's handling of them, several officials said. Thus, President ramps up private criticism of Bondi. Next, we have an article by David Lunau, U.S. Tries Fresh Tack on Regime Change. In the aftermath of the U.S. raid to seize Venezuelan strongman Nicolas Maduro, Washington's trying a new approach to regime change, keep the regime, and try to change its behavior. Having removed Maduro from power, the Trump administration has kept the rest of the dictatorship's hardliners in place, including top officials wanted by the U.S. for drug trafficking and other crimes. It also has gone out of its way to play down the importance of Venezuelan opposition. The goal, administration's officials said, is to force Venezuela's leader in a more U.S.-friendly direction without risking the instability that comes with removing an autocratic government that's been in power for 27 years. Ultimately, it seeks to avoid U.S. boots on the ground in a kind of open-ended occupation that troubled U.S. efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan and proved unpopular with the public. This is not regime change as traditionally conceived. It is regime management, an attempt to reshape behavior without collapsing the system that produces it, said Christopher Hernandez Roy, an analyst at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., who specializes in Latin America. The idea, he said, is to manage Venezuela rather than to liberate it. It's far too early to tell if the strategy will pay off. But its initial success means it could become a template for handling other regimes, such as the one in Iran, where Trump administration is considering strikes against the theocratic government amid a crackdown on protests. Cuba's ossified communist regime could be another target, some analysts said. By taking out Maduro, the Trump administration hopes to get practical change on the cheap, including forcing Venezuela to open its oil industry to U.S. and foreign companies, reduce the flow of drugs to the U.S., and box out China, Russia, and Iran. Any kind of transition to democracy seems a lower priority, at least for now. The approach might be called nation coaching rather than nation building, said Javier Corrales, a political scientist whose research at Amherst College has focused on democracy in Latin America. It's an innovative strategy, Corrales said. The U.S. wants tangible changes from Venezuela's regime, but it doesn't want to send in the Marines, so it outsources stability on the ground to the regime. The big question is whether it will work, he said. For most ordinary Venezuelans, the approach could avoid a bloody civil conflict, but dashes their hopes of a quick transition to democracy or economic recovery. More than a week after the ouster of Maduro, the same corrupt regime remains in place with armed paramilitary squads roaming the streets. One encouraging sign is that several dozen political prisoners have been released in the past week. The strategy is a departure from recent decades during which U.S.-led forces ousted regimes in Iraq and Afghanistan as part of the War on Terror, and in 1989 invaded Panama to topple General Manuel Noriega on drug charges. In all three cases, the U.S. forced the collapse of the pre-existing regime, requiring tens of thousands of U.S. troops to try to keep order and create space for civilians to attempt to help set up a Western-style democracy. Results were mixed at best. Panama became a stable democracy. Iraq endured a protracted civil war and is now a shaky democracy, and Afghanistan reverted to the Taliban. The occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan cost thousands of U.S. lives and cost taxpayers at least $4 trillion, according to estimates by Brown University's Cost of War Project, a cost that turned many people in the U.S. against the idea of exporting democracy. Trump, a Republican, has long said he would avoid that kind of nation-building exercise. After decades of aspiring to remake the world along Western liberal lines, the U.S. is coming to terms with limits on U.S. power, said John Lewis Gaddis, a professor of military history at Yale University. The choice is between accepting that your own power has limits and that you'll have to learn to live with some bad guys, or risk dissipating your power and the domestic roots that sustain it in the interest of turning the world into one of angels, he said. The Trump administration likely concluded that decapitating Venezuela's entire leadership would require a ground invasion and prolonged military presence, risking fragmentation and violence among rival factions of the military and cocaine trafficking groups allied with Maduro and his lieutenants, Hernandez Roy said. A U.S. occupation of Venezuela would likely require at least 100,000 troops, said John Polga Hekimovich, an analyst at the U.S. Naval War College who closely tracks U.S. policy in Venezuela. That figure is short of the peak of about 170,000 in Iraq, but far more than the 27,000 used in Panama, a far smaller country. Trump doesn't have the appetite for that, and his base doesn't have the appetite for that. So the alternative is this, Polga Hekimovich said. It also turns out that while the U.S. isn't very good at nation building, it is good at the kind of strikes the Trump administration has rolled out in the past year, bombing Iran's nuclear facilities and the raid that captured Maduro. Absent a U.S. ground force, an immediate transition to opposition figures after the capture of Maduro was deemed unrealistic by the Trump administration because the opposition would have difficulty leading the government and military, which are staffed by regime loyalists. Trump has said he's open to meeting Venezuela's acting president, Delcy Rodriguez, a regime stalwart who has long been close to Cuba and said she's been very good so far. Opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, who Trump has said lacks the clout to manage a transition in Venezuela, is due to meet Trump on Thursday. She's expected to press him on pushing a transition in Venezuela. Although it doesn't have boots on the ground, the U.S. has leverage. The threat of more military action against uncooperative regime members and the ability to seize Venezuela's oil exports to starve the regime of money. Whether that leverage is enough to press regime leaders to make meaningful changes like an eventual transition to democracy remains to be seen. The U.S. approach comes with risks. It binds the U.S. to a hardline group of Venezuelan officials who have wrecked Venezuela's economy, spent decades working to oppose the U.S., and worked with terrorist groups as well as U.S. enemies like Russia and Iran. Venezuela right now is closer to democracy than it was on January 2nd, but it's also much closer to collapse than January 2nd, Polga Hekimovich said. Maduro held all these rival factions and competing groups together. Can Delcy do the same? Can she toe the line between obeying masters in Washington and keeping armed Chavismo on the ground happy? That U.S. tries fresh tack on regime change. Our next item, middle class gets priced out of Florida retirement. This is by Arian Campo Flores and Paul Overberg, Sarasota, Florida. Michelle Butler and Wells Chapin moved to the west coast of Florida from Michigan in 2023 in anticipation of her plan to exit the restaurant business and join her partner in retirement. They bought a $950,000 home and a new resort-style development in Lakewood Ranch just outside Sarasota that draws many new, well-heeled retirees. Butler, 70 years old, and Chapin, 82, golf at the 18-hole course, ride bikes on winding trails, and enjoy sunsets on their lanai. The following year, Jim and Nina Cope headed in the opposite direction, selling their mobile home in a retirement community in Avon Park, Florida, for $59,000 after repeated rent hikes for the lot. The company, who are in their mid-80s, bought a home for $40,000 in Haleyville, Alabama, where their living expenses are more manageable, with income they get from Social Security and his Navy retirement benefits. The experiences of both couples reflect a new reality about the Sunshine State. Its older population is transforming as the state's costs of living balloon. Wealthy individuals make up a growing share of people at or near retirement age arriving in Florida from other states, according to U.S. Census Bureau data, while many working and middle-class older people who feel priced out are moving elsewhere. The new patterns of migration are helping reshape Florida's identity, swapping its long-held reputation as a paradise for retirees of all stripes for one that primarily caters to the well-heeled. The decades-old promise of an affordable, sun-drenched sanctuary is fading in the face of high home prices, insurance premiums, and property taxes, among other costs. The cost of owning even a modest condo has increased because of recent laws aimed at shoring up condo safety and finances in the wake of the 2021 building collapse in Surfside, Florida. Mobile home parks that once provided a cheap option are becoming pricier as large companies acquire them and raise rents on the land beneath, according to advocates for residents. Or they're disappearing altogether when builders buy them and convert them to costlier housing. Meanwhile, real estate developers are focusing much of their new construction on the high end of the market, featuring projects with amenities including spas, high-tech fitness centers, and premium cuisine. The retiree market is definitely shifting in Florida, said Laura Cole, a senior vice president at Lakewood Ranch, a huge master-planned community that includes posh developments targeted at retirees. The focus has moved from the value buyer to the mid-market and high end. Although older people continue to arrive in greater numbers than those who leave, that net migration has varied by income bracket in the past decade. In 2023, it grew 5% from a decade earlier for households with inflation-adjusted incomes of at least $125,000 and headed by someone 65 or older, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis of census data archived at IPMUS at the University of Minnesota. By comparison, the flow of similar households with inflation-adjusted incomes of $75,000 or less shrank 44%. The pattern was the same for households headed by someone aged 55 to 64. Net migration of the upper income group grew 42%, while for the lower income group it fell 17%. In many Florida counties that lure a lot of retirees, the income of people moving in from other states in 2022 surpassed that of existing residents, said Brad O'Connor, chief economist for Florida Realtors, which compiled the most recent Internal Revenue Service and Census Bureau data. In Collier County, which includes Naples, newcomers from New York, a top feeder state for that county, had average adjusted gross incomes of $401,000, while for those from number two, Illinois, the average was $726,000. The influx of wealthier people has added pressure on home prices. The average home value in Florida was $372,000 in November, a decline from recent years, but a significant increase from 2019, when it was $246,000, according to Zillow. In Miami-Dade County, the share of million-dollar-plus single-family home sales jumped to 25% in 2025 through November from 8% in 2019, an analysis by the Miami Association of Realtors showed. Miami's ultra-luxury market has been sizzling in recent years, with four deals above $100 million in 2025, according to Miller Samuel, an appraisal and consulting firm. Google co-founder Larry Page recently bought two large Miami estates for a combined $173.4 million, the Wall Street Journal reported last week. Developers are catering to wealthy retirees with more upscale offerings. In Moorings Park Communities, a senior luxury living development in Naples, units range from about $600,000 for a 900-square-foot studio to more than $9 million for an 8,800-square-foot penthouse. Amenities include a wellness center, golf simulation lounge, and healthcare services. Keda and David Johnson, both 77, moved there from San Diego in 2021, eager to leave behind California taxes and wildfires, and attracted to the lifestyle in Naples and Moorings Park's focus on successful aging. After accomplished careers, hers as chief operating officer of three senior living companies and his in sales management for medical companies, they could afford a top-notch community. The Johnsons paid $2.5 million for a 3,900-square-foot unit on the golf course. They use the fitness center often and regularly dine with friends in the complex's restaurants. It's luxury living at its finest, Keda Johnson said. Lakewood Ranch has a sprawling array of communities with residences ranging from townhouses in the 200,000s to palatial houses fetching more than $3 million. Home sales grew from 2023 to 2025 in two price categories, $1 million plus and below $300,000, while decreasing in the ranges in between, according to Lakewood Ranch data. At the Esplanade at Azario Development, where Butler and Chapin live, prices range from about $400,000 to more than $2 million. Facilities include a culinary center, salon, and pickleball and tennis courts. Diane Livingston, an IT manager for a pharmaceutical company who lives in Eagleville, Pennsylvania, long dreamed of settling in Florida in her later years. Every time I go down, the stress goes away. People seem happy. They're kind of miserable up here, she said. Livingston, 60, recently closed on a 1,900-square-foot three-bedroom house that cost $726,000, less than what she expects to get for her home in Pennsylvania. Some middle-class Florida retirees are leaving. Will Sawyer, a real estate agent in Greenville, South Carolina, said he has at least 10 clients over the last year and a half who relocated from the Sunshine State, often citing cost-of-living concerns as a reason. They include Michael and Linda Blanc, who had moved from New York to Florida during their working years and eventually settled in Naples. The couple became frustrated with rising costs, such as their home insurance, which was slated to jump $1,000 to $4,800 per year if they didn't get their roof replaced. In 2025, the couple, he, a 66-year-old retired funeral director, and she, a 64-year-old retired nurse, sold their townhome for $350,000 and bought a house on a half acre in Greenville for $320,000. He said many of their costs have gone down, including home insurance and property taxes. Mobile home communities offer some of the last remaining affordable housing in Florida, but even those are getting more expensive, said Patrick McHugh, senior online organizer at MH Action, which advocates for manufactured home residents. Typically, such residents own only the home, not the land beneath, for which they pay lot rent. Many mobile home communities have gone from mom-and-pop operations to corporate ownership, resulting in regular rent increases, he said. One of those feeling the squeeze is Josiah Hadley III, 87, who moved with his now-deceased wife from Pennsylvania to Florida with plans to retire. His monthly lot rent at Royal Palm Village Mobile Home Park in Haines City is slated to climb to nearly $900 this year, compared with $420 when he bought his double-wide 8 years ago. He's held a host of jobs, from service station worker to security, and gets about $2,400 a month in Social Security and a small retirement fund, plus some help from relatives and periodic cash from selling teddy bears he makes by hand. Hadley said he's canceled his cable TV and eats mostly chicken and pasta instead of beef. He said he's considering moving in with one of his daughters in Pennsylvania. Florida doesn't really do anything for me anymore, Hadley said. And that's middle class gets priced out of Florida retirement. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona programming, including the Wall Street Journal, either as it streams or at a time of your choosing by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app from the Apple App Store for your iPad or iPhone, or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet, and you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona as it streams on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show. Next, we'll turn to the business and finance section of the Wall Street Journal for these headlines. Alphabet joins the $4 trillion club. Meta sets high-level initiative to oversee AI effort, and Paramount plans proxy campaign to push its hostile bid for Warner. That first headline, Alphabet joins the $4 trillion club. Optimism about AI grows after Apple unveils Siri deal with Google's Gemini. It's by Catherine Blunt and Rolf Winkler. Google parent Alphabet's value reached $4 trillion, making it the latest tech company to cross that threshold as investors reward the internet search leader for its artificial intelligence gains. Shares in Alphabet rose 1% to a record $331.86 Monday, putting its market capitalization at $4.009 trillion. Its shares rose 65% last year. Four technology companies have traded at market capitalizations of $4 trillion. Nvidia is still above that mark. Apple and Microsoft, both of which crossed the $4 trillion threshold last year, now have market capitalizations below that mark. Google pulled well ahead in the race to develop AI with the recent launch of its Gemini 3 model, which earned praise for its speed, intelligence, and creative capabilities. It outperformed competing models on more than a dozen benchmark tests, scoring a range of intelligence categories. Gemini now has more than 650 million monthly users, up from 450 million last summer. The model's success poses challenges for OpenAI, Anthropic, and other AI startups. OpenAI's ChatGPT is still by far the most popular AI chatbot, and Anthropic's Claude is regarded as one of the best models for coding, but Gemini 3's advances have made it more capable for use in a wider range of applications. Demonstrating Google's AI prowess, Apple on Monday announced that it had selected Gemini to power a more personalized version of its Siri chatbot coming later this year. Apple has struggled to develop AI tools of its own, and Siri's capabilities badly lag behind chatbots available from others. Apple said it had entered a multi-year collaboration with Google to use Gemini as the foundation of its own AI models. These models will help power future Apple Intelligence features, including a more personalized Siri coming this year, it said. The rise in Alphabet shares last year marks a significant reversal in investor sentiment. The launch of ChatGPT in 2022 stoked fears at Alphabet that its Google search engine would lose significant traffic to chatbots, and the company was slow to launch competitive AI models. During its annual developers conference in May, Google unveiled a series of sophisticated AI products and a revamped version of a search engine featuring AI mode, which answers search queries in a chatbot-style conversation. Still, some investors doubted whether the new tools would be enough to give the company an edge against its competitors. Then in August, the debut of image generation tool Nano Banana launched Gemini usage on its fastest trajectory to date, in part by appealing to younger users. The company said most of the growth has come from users between 18 and 34 years old. The company then won significant victory in September when a federal judge declined to impose harsh penalties on the company after earlier finding it maintained an illegal monopoly in the search market. The judge said the AI race had made the search market more competitive already. News Corporation, owner of the Wall Street Journal, has commercial agreements to supply content on Google platforms and through Apple services. Alphabet recently reported record quarterly revenue, largely because of growth in cloud computing and advertising. Its cloud business has become a core revenue driver, jumping 34% year over year. Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway revealed on November 14th that it had purchased 17.8 million shares of Alphabet during the third quarter, according to a securities filing. The shares were valued at more than $4.3 billion at the end of September. And that's Alphabet joins $4 trillion club. Our next article is by Megan Bobrovsky and Connor Hart. Meta sets high-level initiative to oversee AI effort. Meta Platforms is going all in on building out AI infrastructure. The company on Monday created a new top-level initiative led by top executives to secure the enormous amounts of computing power its artificial intelligence models need. It also named a new president and vice chair, Dina Powell McCormick, to work on developing partnerships with governments to finance and deploy data centers across the world. Meta is planning to build tens of gigawatts this decade and hundreds of gigawatts or more over time, Meta chief executive Mark Zuckerberg wrote in a post on the Threads app. How we engineer, invest, and partner to build this infrastructure will become a strategic advantage. The new initiative is called Meta Compute and will be led by longtime Meta executive Santosh Janardhan and Daniel Gross, a new AI hire who previously co-founded Safe Superintelligence with Ilya Sutskever. Powell McCormick, one of the most senior women on Wall Street and a former Trump advisor, will help with the projects by working closely with Janardhan and Gross, Zuckerberg said in a post. Beyond that, she will also guide Meta's overall strategy and execution in a wide-ranging, newly created role. Powell McCormick previously joined Meta's board in April and stepped down in December. She now reports to Zuckerberg. President Trump on Monday congratulated Powell McCormick in a social media post. "A great choice by Mark Z," he said, referring to Zuckerberg. "She is a fantastic and very talented person who served the Trump administration with strength and distinction." Meta is racing to develop superhuman intelligence after spending heavily on talent and embarking on investments in new data centers and related infrastructure. It is building a $27 billion data center in Louisiana and last week unveiled agreements that would make it an anchor customer for new and existing nuclear power projects in the U.S. to secure electricity for its vast computing needs. Meta has already announced financing plans for at least one new project, the data center in Louisiana. The company moved the project off its books into a new joint venture with investment manager Blue Owl Capital. Powell McCormick's appointment also comes as Meta continues to try to deepen ties with the current administration. Powell McCormick has more than 25 years of experience, including 16 years at Goldman Sachs as a partner in senior leadership roles. Born in Egypt, she spent more than a dozen years during the early part of her career working in various U.S. government roles, including Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategy under Trump. At Goldman, she was a global head of the sovereign business, focusing on strengthening the investment bank's ties with government-backed funds, particularly those in the Middle East. Powell McCormick left Goldman in 2023 to join an investment and advisory firm run by former partners at the Wall Street firm. She's married to David McCormick, a Republican who won a Pennsylvania Senate race in 2024 and had been Undersecretary of the Treasury for International Affairs during the George W. Bush administration. In the fall, Meta investors started to get nervous about the company's plans to spend aggressively on artificial intelligence infrastructure this year without a clear timeline on when they would see returns. Its stock dropped more than 7% in after-hours trading when Zuckerberg said Meta's spending would accelerate beyond the $72 billion it had been expecting to spend last year on its AI build-out. Meta has been trying to catch up in the AI race and spending lavishly to get there, doling out pay packages in the tens and hundreds of millions of dollars and acquiring startups including Singapore-based Manus for more than $2 billion. Investors have begun to lose patience, and Meta's stock is down nearly 9% over the past 3 months. The new computing announcement and Powell McCormick's appointment didn't appear to be enough to assuage investor jitters. Meta stock ticked slightly down in trading on Monday. That's MetaSet's high-level initiative to oversee AI effort. Our next item, Paramount plans proxy campaign to push its hostile bid for Warner. This is by Joe Flint and Lauren Thomas. Paramount Skydance plans to launch a proxy fight for board seats at Warner Brothers Discovery, the company said Monday, as it continues pushing its hostile bid for the company. Paramount also filed a lawsuit seeking to force Warner to release more information about its merger agreement with Netflix. Paramount has long argued its offer, which Warner repeatedly rebuffed, is superior in value to Netflix. Warner has provided increasingly novel reasons for avoiding a transaction with Paramount, but what it has never said, because it cannot, is that the Netflix transaction is financially superior to our actual offer, Paramount said. Warner on Monday said Paramount is seeking to distract with a meritless lawsuit and attacks on a board that has delivered an unprecedented amount of shareholder value. It said Paramount continues to push a transaction that its board unanimously concluded isn't superior to its deal with Netflix. The suit escalates Paramount's pursuit of Warner and casts the spotlight on Warner's stable of cable networks such as CNN and TNT. Paramount is seeking to buy all of Warner, including its cable networks, for $77.9 billion. Netflix is only looking to acquire the company's movie and TV studios and HBO channel and related streaming business for $72 billion after Warner splits itself in two, leaving its cable TV networks and a separately publicly traded company. Part of Warner's reasoning for favoring Netflix's deal has been the fact that its stockholders would retain shares in a portion of the company that Netflix doesn't buy, giving them access to potential upside. Paramount, on the other hand, said last week that it believes that business isn't worth anything. Paramount's lawsuit, filed in Delaware, seeks to force Warner to release information about how it valued the Netflix transaction and how it values the network's business. It also seeks information on a clause in the Netflix deal that would allow for a reduction in purchase price if Warner restructures its debt, asking how it might work. Paramount says it intends to nominate a slate of director candidates ahead of Warner's annual shareholder meeting when the window to do so opens in 3 weeks. Paramount argued it was necessary to nominate its own candidates who will engage with Paramount's offer in accordance with their fiduciary duties if Warner's current board members don't. We don't undertake any of these actions lightly, Paramount also said, adding that the company's goal is still to have constructive discussions with the Warner board. Paramount's tender offer for Warner is set to expire on January 21st, but can be extended. Both a Paramount and a Netflix deal with Warner would need regulatory approval. President Trump has also weighed in with concerns about the combination of Netflix with Warner's HBO Max streaming service, as well as concerns about Paramount and coverage of him by its CBS News unit. On Sunday, Trump posted a link to a December opinion piece from the right-leaning news channel One America News Network, critical of a Warner-Netflix tie-up. The piece argued that Netflix has repeatedly used its platform to elevate progressive narratives. Netflix declined to comment. And that's Paramount Plan's proxy campaign to push its hostile bid for Warner. Well, let's turn now to the Heard on the Street section of the Wall Street Journal. And we have this article, China Faces Curbs on Black Market Oil. Official market for crude could soon start to feel disturbances as the U.S. and Europe crack down on illicit trading. For now, the official oil price is calm, but the U.S. attack on Venezuela is creating pressure on the shadowy market for sanctioned crude and its biggest customer, China. Brent, the main international benchmark, is trading around $63 a barrel, and has risen less than $3 since President Nicolas Maduro was captured. Some additional supply from Venezuela has been priced into oil futures, but it'll take time for this to be felt in the physical market. Even if there is a smooth political transition, it will take at least a couple of years to fix Venezuela's neglected oil infrastructure and raise production. The blockade around Venezuela and America's seizure of oil tankers is a major warning to the market for dark barrels. The volume of oil under Western sanctions stands at a record 15% of the world supply based on Kpler data. A shadow fleet of vessels that transports this sanctioned oil has ballooned to a fifth of global deadweight tonnage, data from maritime journal Lloyd's List shows. Western powers are increasing pressure on these tankers. America seized three in international waters last week. Low oil prices and plentiful supply are giving U.S. and European leaders a rare window to do something about illicit trading without triggering a fresh bout of energy inflation for their voters. Maduro's overthrow is a problem for China. Along with India, it has been the biggest beneficiary of the flow of heavily discounted oil that Western sanctions created. Beijing has been getting a third of its total oil imports from Iran, Russia, and Venezuela, Kpler data shows. This lowered its energy bills. China saved nearly $9 a barrel on Venezuelan oil delivered in November, compared with what it would have paid for an equivalent heavy crude from Canada, according to commodity data provider Argus Media. Now, the roughly 500,000 barrels a day of Venezuelan crude that China used to mop up will likely be diverted to U.S. refineries. The White House said sanctions on Venezuela will be selectively rolled back in the coming days. This will shift supply from illicit channels to the mainstream market, reducing the discount on Venezuela's crude and immediately boosting the country's oil revenue. Although heavy crude from Canada and other countries has become cheaper in recent days on expectations that the U.S. will replace Canadian barrels with Venezuelan oil, it's still much more expensive than what China is used to paying. A strategy of buying cheap, sanctioned oil left China vulnerable to disruption. The attack on Venezuela is the third time in less than a year that Chinese energy imports were threatened by the White House's activities. Israel's attack on Iran last summer, aided by the U.S., made Chinese buyers nervous about the possibility of strikes on the Islamic Republic's energy export facilities. China's independent teapot refineries in the Shandong region take 90% of Iran's sanctioned crude. In October, the U.S. sanctioned Russian oil producers Lukoil and Rosneft, making it riskier to buy Moscow's crude. The latest upheaval of evil in Venezuela vindicates China's drive to hoard oil. The country has been buying barrels far in excess of its domestic needs over the past year and socking them away in storage. Its heavy crude stockpiles are big enough to last until March, said Tom Reed, vice president of China Crude at Argus Media. After that, it will need to find alternative suppliers, possibly Canada or Colombia. And longer term, Beijing may need to reassess the risks of investing in Latin America, where the Trump administration seems determined to flex its muscles and box out Russia and China. China Concord Resources recently started developing two oil fields in Venezuela and plans to invest more than $1 billion in a project to reach 60,000 barrels of oil a day by the end of 2026, JP Morgan analysts say. The future of this and other upstream investments in Venezuela is now up in the air. Iran, too, is looking less reliable as anti-regime protests there rage on. A crackdown on illicit oil trading is risky, even with a global glut of crude. Russia is becoming more aggressive about defending its shadow fleet. Last week, it sent a submarine to the North Atlantic, where a tanker was pursued by the U.S. Coast Guard and seized. Last year, Moscow scrambled jets in Estonian airspace after Estonia's navy tried to detain a Russian tanker. Moscow is allowing more vessels carrying sanctioned oil to sail openly under the Russian flag, which is a new development. This means it's no longer hiding the real origin of the oil and may be testing whether Europe and the U.S. have the stomach to seize more Russian ships. According to Lloyd's List, 42 vessels have switched to sailing under the Russian flag over the past 6 months. The oil price isn't reflecting geopolitical risk because there is so much spare supply. But pressure is building in the sanctioned market. Millions of barrels of dark oil are languishing in tankers on the ocean, unable to find buyers, as enforcement steps up and producers try to find ways to skirt the latest round of sanctions. The black market is now so large, at 6 million barrels a day, that further disruptions to supply there could quickly send the official oil price higher. This article was by Carol Ryan. China faces curbs on black market oil. We have time for at least a little part of "The Oil Patch Gets Its Own NVIDIAs." It's a cliche, but the best businesses to own in a gold rush are really the ones selling picks and shovels. That's meant chipmakers NVIDIA and Advanced Micro Devices during the artificial intelligence boom became the top-performing large stocks of the past decade. Younger investors might never have heard of two of this year's surprise standouts. Halliburton was last a hot news item 24 years ago when then Vice President Dick Cheney's role as former chief executive came under scrutiny. SLB, formerly Schlumberger, was one of the world's most valuable companies back in 1980. The oil field service providers are a shadow of their former selves, worth $80 billion combined at the end of 2025. More shocking, the S&P 500 energy sector, which includes America's largest oil and gas producers, had a market value barely a third as much as NVIDIA. One reason service stocks languished is the inverse of why companies like NVIDIA and other members of the Magnificent Seven thrived. Instead of being capital light, they provide the picks and shovels of the energy business, but mostly get stuck with them when prices and exploration activities sink. Who needs that? Well, the U.S. energy industry does at the moment, and it might pay top dollar. Venezuela's decrepit infrastructure atop the world's largest oil reserves cries out for the sophisticated reservoir knowledge and equipment only leading service firms can provide. President Trump has said major U.S. oil companies would invest $100 billion in the country's oil sector, and analysts agree it could cost that much, or might be wishful thinking. Oil companies gave Trump a cool response on Friday, with ExxonMobil's boss calling Venezuela uninvestable. Well, that's just a part of "The Oil Patch Gets Its Own NVIDIAs," an article by Spencer Jacob from Heard on the Street. You've been listening to The Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona programming as it streams or at a time of your choosing by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website, sunsounds.org, or downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app from the Apple App Store for your iPad or iPhone, or your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store, and you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show.